This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. The words archaeology and shipwrecks may conjure up images of Indiana Jones, pirates, and treasure hunters, and that has been a part of the history of underwater archaeology. But shipwrecks can offer valuable historical and cultural insights, as we'll hear this hour. Dr. Brendan Foley is research specialist in the Department of Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dr. Theotokos Theodoulou is maritime archaeologist for the Hellenic Ministry of Culture's Department of Underwater Antiquities. The two have been working together for nearly a decade investigating shipwrecks around the Aegean Sea, and it is a pleasure to welcome you both.
Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm. Brendan, tell us, what is it that we can really gain from looking at shipwrecks in an academic sense?
Shipwrecks, to me, are nothing more than a repository of information about the ancient past. Shipwrecks are particularly interesting because we find things on shipwrecks that we can't find in any other environment. So ships are transporting goods, they're transporting cargo, people, and ideas. That's all quite useful. Well, we can find some of those same bits of material culture on land. Often we're finding things underwater that just don't survive on land. So an excellent example is the bronze statues that we find in some of the museums in Athens and elsewhere in the Mediterranean. Bronze statues certainly did exist on land, but over the years they've been melted down, they've been recycled, been reused. Underwater, it's out of sight and out of mind. So if we go to the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, there are maybe a dozen beautiful bronze statues from 5th, 4th, 3rd centuries BC. Almost all of them have come from sites underwater. Now, that's just the most photogenic example of information that can be retrieved from the sea. There's plenty of other examples. Most recently, we've been looking at DNA trapped inside transport jars, sort of the 55-gallon drums of antiquity. We have an entirely new look now of what the value-added products were, what people were actually eating in the ancient past, what their medicines were, maybe even what their perfumes were. So information that doesn't survive anywhere else can be found underwater on shipwreck sites.
That seems almost counterintuitive to me in some ways. I can see how putting them at the bottom of the ocean obviously gets them out of the reach of people who want to remelt the bronze later and use it for something else. But what is it about the marine environment that's actually preserving some of these materials?
If you get into the deep sea, it's a very stable temperature, a very stable salinity, and there's no light. So for some things, not for all things, for some things, it's really the perfect preservative environment.
So Theotokos, you were also saying that ships are kind of like time capsules, that they're a window into a very specific moment, that on land you would be getting a larger spread of time if you were to look at a city or some other archaeological site, as opposed to a shipwreck just being very discreet.
In land, certain places, certain areas used to be used and reused during centuries, during millennia. So in just a stratum of 10 centimeters of sediment, you have 100 or 200 years history. But in the case of shipwrecks, it's really a time capsule, because it is an accident, of course. It is an event that happened in a very certain moment, coming from a very certain area, loaded in very certain objects. So you have the ability to go there and have a look of this picture that was stabilized 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. So it's really like a window to the past. Before the development of autonomous scuba diving in 1943, all these sites were undisturbed. It's nowadays that people can reach the sea bed and disturb them. Otherwise, it was there until, and there are some intact until now. I mean, okay, quite a lot of them are disturbed more or less anymore. But there are sites which are really undisturbed, where you can gain all this kind of information that Brendan discovered described before, and even more, because you know that during antiquity the usual way of transporting loads, ideas, civilizations and everything was through the sea. Because the land needs roads, and roads were something not able to be built, created, if you don't have a central government that can arrange all of these needs. So we have the first roads, paved roads, appropriate for transporting purposes in Roman Empire, concerning the as far as Mediterranean concerned. Of course, Persians even before, and of course during Alexander the Great times, they were exist under those empires, roads guiding from the capitals to the harbors, to the ports again. But the main way of transporting was through the sea. So we can have the knowledge of the whole era through the what we find in shipwrecks.
Well, and obviously 2,000, 3,000 years ago, where history and culture was really blossoming was around the shores of the Mediterranean, Egypt, Constantinople, Greece, Rome. It's not in every country that you're going to find actually a ministry of underwater antiquities. This is obviously an important part of Greek history. What kind of resources and what kind of import actually go into studying the shipwrecks that are in Greek waters?
Look, unfortunately, in these days, everything becomes a little bit more difficult, of course. But and in fact, we're never a Ministry of Underwater Archaeology. We're a Department of the Archaeological Service of the Ministry of Culture. But even though the Ephorate of Underwater Antiquities of Greece was one of the first created, and around Mediterranean, that became a need after, let's say, 60s, when the scuba diving had a past of 20, 30 years already. So illegal actions took place, and that the need of legislation controlling all this came to the surface, and that the several states around Mediterranean started creating those kind of services. Of course, in the certain case of Greece, we had some funding from the state. And it was always a vivid interest from foreign institutions to participate in that. And fortunately, after 2000, there was an extroversy attitude at the Greek Ministry of Culture, and that was the time when we started cooperating with other institutions like Gutskol. It was 2001 when Brendan first came in Greece, and from then on we have a stable, almost annual cooperation project.
So Brendan Foley, how did this cooperative relationship with Greek scientists and with the Greek government come about for you, from your perspective here from Woods Hole?
Well, it actually started when I was still at MIT. As I was looking forward, as I was finishing up my PhD, other colleagues in archaeology said, well, you really ought to think about working in Turkey or maybe working in Italy because Greece will be impossible. You'll never get a permit to work. And I thought, aha.
Just bureaucracy or?
Yeah, the way it works, each country, each foreign country that has archaeologists that wish to work in Greece establishes a school. So there's the American School of Classical Studies in Athens. The American school then is offered a number of permits every year by the Greek government, and it's six or seven. But that's six or seven permits to cover all of the American archaeological research that's ongoing in Greece.
Well, and do we have a sense of how many wrecks are there in Greek waters that might be of interest?
Well, I don't know about just Greek waters, but I ran some rough estimates, some calculations, and I figure over 2,000 or 3,000 years of seafaring history in the Mediterranean, the conservative estimate is there's about 3/4 of a million shipwrecks from the ancient world waiting out there to be discovered.
They're not all going to be, though, of really intense academic interest, right? I mean, some of them...
We think about shipwrecks as these romantic sites. And you say shipwreck to anyone and usually hear back from them, is there gold on it and are there sharks? Well, we haven't seen any sharks and we don't find any gold. Shipwrecks are more like car accidents, but there are no tow trucks in the deep ocean. So you think every car accident, if it were just left on the side of the road, there'd be a lot of car accidents to look at. And some of those would be interesting for archaeologists 1,000 years from now to look into, but not every one of them. And that's really the way it works with the shipwreck archaeology too. We go out, we survey huge areas. We try to build a massive database of all the shipwrecks that are out there. And then from that database, we extract the ones that we think are going to be the most important in terms of delivering new information about the past.
So what kind of things might give you a clue that a shipwreck would be interesting to research further?
The number one thing is always age. The farther back in time we get, the smaller the sample size is of shipwrecks or even land sites for archaeology.
And is that because fewer survive or there were fewer boats on the ocean?
Both of those things, yeah. And as we get farther back in time, we get to the proto-historical period or the prehistorical period before written language is invented, then the only way really to learn about the past is through the material remains. We can't read about it. There's no written language.
So you have to go out there and actually dig it up and figure out what was going on.
Exactly right.
So tell me a little bit about the Antikythera wreck. This is a wreck that you've both been working on. And first of all, you call it a treasure wreck. What is a treasure wreck?
The Antikythera wreck is a treasure wreck. It's an amazing story that goes along with this shipwreck. Around 1900, some Greek sponge divers were coming back from their fishing season on the North African coast, and they came up to this little island, Antikythera, which is in the strait between mainland Greece, the Peloponnese, and the island of Crete. A storm blew up, and they tucked into the lee of the island and spent some days there waiting for the weather to abate before they could continue on home. So after a few days, they decided to drop over the side, and this is in those large bronze helmets, you know, at the turn of the century, with surface supplied air, buoys on the surface turning a crank to provide air for the diver down below. So this diver went down over the side of the boat and pulled the line to be brought up. It was an emergency, and they hauled him back to the deck, and he was screaming about landing on top of rotting corpses. Well, they weren't rotting corpses. It was a shipwreck full of bronze and marble statues of human figures and horses and just an amazing, amazing cargo. They spent about 2 years excavating this wreck, or really salvaging this wreck. They got dozens and dozens of marble statues and some beautiful bronze statues, gold jewelry, coins. This was really a ship that was transporting treasure. Now, there are a couple of different theories about why treasure would be on this ship assembled like this. One is that it was simply a cargo of material that had been commissioned by the wealthy upper class in Rome, and it was going back to Rome. But another theory is that a Roman general had just looted Asia Minor and was carrying back exactly that, loot and treasure, for his triumphal parade back through the streets of Rome. If you look to the written sources, you'd find that generals did this often, and these triumphal parades could last for days. It'd be wild animals, it would be slaves, it would be all of the wealth that they were able to basically steal from these lands that they had just conquered, put on public display. So possibly one of those two answers is the backstory to the Antikythera shipwreck.
So we've got a bunch of bronze statues, and you said a lot of it was kind of salvaged and brought up. But then there's also this fascinating Antikythera mechanism, which is essentially like an analog computer that's 2,000 years old.
This may be the most astounding artifact that's ever been recovered from an archaeological site. Our dive safety officer here at Woods Hole likens it to finding an iPad on the wreck of a Viking ship. It's that far out of its time period. So it is exactly as you described it. It's an analog computer. It's a gear train of at least 30 gears, all made of bronze, and it encapsulates all of the astronomical knowledge of the ancient world. So by turning one main drive crank on the side of this mechanism, on dials on two faces of this machine, you would see indications of the positions of the five known planets, the phase of the sun and the moon. It timed the Olympic Games and the three other...
Pythia, Nemeap, Yeah, anyway.
But these, other, were all essentially like known, Olympic...
Yeah. They were quite important religious athletic celebrations with which they probably marked the year. So they were counting the years by those events.
So, I mean, it sounds almost like a clock, except on a not on a minutes and hours kind of scale, but this is almost a clock that tells you about months or years where you are in the.
No. I'm talking about the athletic events as a counting of the year. The mechanism counts actually the phases of the moon, the solar eclipses, and also moon eclipses. What else?
And you can crank it forward to predict, but can you crank it in reverse as well?
Yes,
I think
can.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So yeah, and the amazing thing is that now we are our knowledge is enough to know that we don't live in a geocentric globe. We know that the sun is at the middle and other planets are going around. Those people at that time didn't have this knowledge. They had a geocentric system.
So they thought the Earth was at the... This was still when they thought the Earth was at the middle of the solar system.
Exactly. But even though they managed to build a mechanism loaded with all the results of their observation, which was giving correct estimations.
So, I mean, it had to be built more on empirical
knowledge,
not really theoretical, because it wouldn't have worked right if they were basing it on a theory of going around the Earth.
Exactly. They took a wrong theory, and they proved they managed to figure out a correct result.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Brendan Foley of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Dr. Theotokos Theodoulou of the Hellenic Ministry of Culture's Department of Underwater Antiquities. We're talking about their research on shipwrecks in Greek waters. We'll talk more after a short break. Before the break, we were talking about the Antikythera mechanism, essentially an analog computer dating back thousands of years that was found on this shipwreck, the Antikythera. So when this was found, how did anybody know how to use it?
Well, two things. When the mechanism first came up in 1901, they recognized that it was something unique right away. They could see some of the gear teeth and some of the inscriptions around this geared mechanism, but it was heavily concreted. The marine organisms had built up calcified layers over this thing, and it was fragmentary. It wasn't really until the 1950s, with the advent of X-ray imaging, that people began to understand that there was a lot more to this thing than they realized. And it was about the same time that they realized there was a lot more inscription than they had previously realized. Actually, there was a bronze plate on the back of the mechanism, which was an owner's manual. It told you how to use the machine.
That's incredible.
It's absolutely incredible.
They literally took the time to inscribe a user's manual onto a bronze plate and attach it to the mechanism.
That's right. And the script is very small. Some of the letters are about 2 or 3 millimeters in height. So
is this thinking that this was being used on board the ship for some sort of navigational purposes, or with a user's manual included, was this being handed off to somebody new?
This was, well, first, it was not a navigational instrument. This was being transported somewhere to give to someone, and it was old by the time it sank.
How do you know that?
Well, it's based partly on the epigraphy, partly on the shape of the letters, because different regions of Greece had different shape for their letters, and those shapes changed through time. So that's part of it.
When first was recognized, they thought that it was an astrolabe, a navigational instrument, but that, of course, was not the case. And there is recently a team, an international team, working on it. Actually, they've brought a big X-ray instrument equipment, and they brought that in Athens National Museum because it's forbidden for the mechanism to get out of the museum. So they brought that equipment there, and they managed to read every certain word on the mechanism, and they even recognized more what's the word for the gears, yes. And so they now know almost sure the use of that. A point I would like to add is that as our friend Ed O'Brien remarked, it was like an iPad found on a Viking's wreck. And this is true, because that could not be created at a moment without any background. That should be an end of a series. They didn't start to build such a thing, and they managed to achieve such a perfect result at one moment. So, and of course, we have written sources referring to clever gears of the past, clever mechanisms of the past. But this is the only one we have. So it's quite obvious that there are more, even more developed or less developed.
So, I mean, but this is the only one that's ever been found underwater or on land.
Yeah.
So we have no idea what the, as you said, there's got to be something that led to this. This is not your first attempt at at a geared mechanism. Mm-hmm. You don't come up with something like this. And then for them to just disappear, I mean, this is a huge mystery.
Yeah. It must be not something that usual as today is all these technological objects we are using. But even though, if they were metal, metal was precious. So they were melted and everything. They disappeared. They must be some samples somewhere.
Is there anything written about mechanisms like this?
Yes, there are ancient sources referring to discoveries of the past. I mean, even the primitive sample of a steam engine was back to the Hellenistic era of 2nd, 3rd century BC. We also know that they were automatic flames in several temples. Or there was quite a lot of appliances, mechanisms.
There were technologies that...
Yeah. They were turning things and...
And somehow that was then lost and not recovered for hundreds of years.
Yes, actually, the knowledge was existing. It was an existing knowledge that due to the social status, I mean, we have... if you have a peaceful time, then all these things can be flourishing. If not, then the main attempt goes to eating and survive.
So, right, you've got to take care of the basics of life.
Yeah. So, and Hellenistic era and Roman era were very peaceful and productive eras. But later on, we have all these conflicts around the Mediterranean. So we have all these purity spread all over. And that knowledge was not useful anymore because they had to face quite more serious surviving troubles to solve.
Now, Brendan, I know that you are planning to go back to the Antikythera wreck. What is left to be discovered there? We've got all these bronze statues. We've got this incredible mechanism already in the museum. What's to go back for?
That's the most delicious part. We're not really sure. The wreck was salvaged in 1900. In 1976, Jacques Cousteau was invited by the Greek government to go back and make a television show. So he took the Calypso and a team of divers, and they spent about 27 days in the summer and in the autumn, and they did some excavation. Well, they did some digging, I guess is a better way. If you say excavation, you think of archaeological integrity being maintained. That's not exactly what they did. But they digged dug in a few square meters of the wreck and recovered over 200 artifacts. Everything from small bronze statuettes to stacks of coins, more gold jewelry, of course, plenty of ceramics and coarseware, small vials that would have held perfume or possibly medicine, beautiful glass bowls, and even some human remains. And this was all in a very, very small area, just a few square feet. No one's ever looked in deeper water right next to this area where they were digging previously, so we just don't know what we're going to find, but we know that if there are artifacts on this wreck, they're likely to be really quite significant.
In going back and looking in particular in deeper water, you start needing a lot of technology. It becomes harder to get humans down there, or you even get into robotics. And I know that the use of robotics is actually pretty central to your personal philosophy for how we should be doing deep sea archaeology.
The deep sea floor is a vast repository of information. It's you could think about shipwrecks as being books, and each artifact is a page in the book. And the deep sea floor then is an enormous library with all of these books sort of shelved down there. With the technology we have here at Woods Hole, we can go out and access that library. So autonomous underwater vehicles, that's our library card. We can go down and survey these vast, vast areas of seafloor and find these very, very subtle targets and then apply all kinds of different technologies to investigate those shipwreck sites. So whether it's autonomous underwater vehicles or remotely operated vehicles or human-occupied vehicles or in some cases even technical diving, we now have the technology to access these sites that have been out of sight and out of mind for thousands of years.
So you guys, I know that's part of why you both, and you have a graduate student with you as well, that are here in Woods Hole now, is in part to get up to speed, I guess, on some of those technologies and in part the diving to get humans down there as well.
That's right. Theotokos and I and others from Woods Hole and the Ministry of Culture have been working together since 2001. But this is Theotokos' first trip to America and his first trip to Woods Hole.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
He's seen our technology. We've brought several systems over to Greece, and he's been an active part of the operations team. But having him come to America and seeing our facility, observing our operation, touring the ship, we had lunch on the Nore the other day, and seeing the new vehicle that James Cameron has donated to the Oceanographic, and seeing the Nereus hybrid remotely operated vehicle, and talking to all of our scientists, I'm hoping that he'll go back home with an expanded view of what's actually possible for our science and other sciences.
This is, as we already talked about, you know, a huge part of Greek's history, of the world's history, but Greece is a small country and one experiencing financial difficulties at the moment. Is there ever any tension with scientists from the United States coming over with all of this technology and wanting to explore? Or is this really something that you welcome as a way to be able to explore this history and culture?
Look, I have to be honest. Until some point in the past, let's say until the almost the end of the decade of 90s, some efforts have been done to include also for institutions to the research, but they were not, let's say, not very much successful. But from then on, I think the attitude of us first, and I mean the Greeks, starts changing. So we were able anymore to let's say, to get the profit of all this cooperation.
What is that profit in your mind? What's the benefit?
Look, first of all, as you very accurately pointed out, Greek civilization is not just an issue of Greeks. It's a global thing. On Greek civilization, the whole Western civilization is based.
And that must be a point of pride for you and for all Greek citizens.
Yeah, and from this point of view, we have to share it anyway. And since we didn't have that technology to keep going deeper and covering wider areas and everything and mapping quite quickly and all these abilities that modern technology gives, which you here in Woods Hole create, actually. the cooperation started, of course, as a test at the beginning, and it was so fruitful that I think that we are not just colleagues anymore. We are friends, sharing the same beliefs and same attitudes and same way of working and everything. And I must say that after these years of cooperation, not only the F4AID, but also the Hellenic Center of Marine Research, the most involved to marine research institution in Greece, we managed after these years of cooperation with Guttural mainly, to gain the data of an industry, of an operation that took place in the Adriatic Sea in between Greece and Italy for a pipeline recently. And they managed to locate three unknown wrecks in more than 1,000 meters down below, which is something that could not happen a decade ago.
You wouldn't even be able to locate them, let alone go down and do anything.
Yeah, I think that we were not able, we didn't have the know-how to interpret this this data. But due to the very harmonic cooperation we have and the attitude of sharing things and knowledge too, even just Greek institutions now are able to do such a work. Of course, I must say that it's quite obvious that it must be kept this way. This cooperation process is quite important and essential for both institutions and for the global science, I think.
So you've learned from it, but you think it's important to,
yeah,
to
yeah.
keep. Brendan, from your perspective, what does this collaboration bring to you or to the science besides, obviously, access?
Well, the number one thing, of course, is the access, at least to the outside observer. You would think that would be the most important thing. But, well, we bring technological expertise and funding and those sorts of things. What we don't have is local knowledge, and we also don't have the deep, deep understanding of the culture, both today and in the past. So when we're on the ship or on the shore, even with the Theotokos and Demetris and the other Greek archaeologists, we basically have the world experts on Greek archaeology, Greek civilization right there. And that's something that can never be replicated. So just their knowledge and their intuition is priceless.
You're listening to Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are Dr. Brendan Foley of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Dr. Theotokos Theodoulou of the Hellenic Ministry of Culture's Department of Underwater Antiquities. We'll talk more after a short break.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
Welcome back. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm joined this hour by Dr. Brendan Foley of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Dr. Theotokos Theodoulou of the Hellenic Ministry of Culture's Department of Underwater Antiquities, and we're talking about their underwater archaeology research. Let's talk a little bit about the technology necessary to actually go down and do these investigations. What is the toolbox that you're taking down with you now?
Well, it's getting bigger and bigger. We have to keep adding drawers to the toolbox. We started out, underwater archaeology started out with scuba diving. Slowly over the years, that's been expanded now to incorporating robotics, especially the approach we take here at Woods Hole Oceanographic. So it's very heavy on technology. We typically use autonomous underwater vehicles to go out and survey for the shipwrecks, and then some combination of robotic vehicles to go down and investigate those shipwrecks further. But the most recent thing that we've added into this is technical diving. So it's wonderful to be able to go out into the very deep abyssal depths of the Mediterranean or the Aegean. But that requires a lot of expensive technology and a big expensive support ship. It turns out that there are thousands of wrecks right up near shore in divable depths or slightly beyond normal divable depths. And the Ministry of Culture, the Theotokos' department, the effort of underwater antiquities, has a list of these wrecks, many of them reported by fishermen or spear fishermen. We can go out and very, very quickly in the near shore environment investigate these wrecks using technical diving capabilities. So that's some of the toolkits: closed circuit rebreathers, autonomous underwater vehicles, diver propulsion vehicles, DNA testing kits. Slowly, this toolkit is expanding.
Now, the DNA testing that you mentioned, that's a really interesting one that your wife actually is your collaborator in this regard. You guys have done some really groundbreaking research using essentially forensic DNA technologies to actually look at what was inside some of the amphoras where before, I guess, we were guessing based on shape or size or other context what might have been inside those amphoras, and you guys have actually been able to directly test that.
That's right. Maria Hansen was a postdoc here at Woods Hole in Mark Hahn's lab in the biology department, and I met her when I was a postdoc. And over dinner one night, I was talking about archaeology, and I was describing to her some of these amphoras, these two-handled ceramic jugs, which are specifically designed for the maritime transport of liquid or semi-liquid goods. I was describing to her these jars we had just recovered from a 4th century BC shipwreck off Chios in Greece. And she said, well, what was in them? I said, well, I've gone through the literature, and it seems like any jar from Chios is usually identified as containing wine, because wine was the famous export from Chios. And she said, well, that's not very good science. You can't just assume that the contents were wine just because it came from a place. And I said, yeah, but what's our alternative? There's no method to actually test an empty jar. And she said, well, has anyone ever tried to extract trace DNA from these empty jars? Maybe there's still DNA left in the ceramic matrix.
So the DNA, obviously, if these were plant products, we're talking about the plant DNA that would have been left there.
Exactly right. Land plants. So I called Theotokos and his colleague, my colleague, Dimitris Korkamelis, and explained what Maria's idea was. And they gave us permission to come over to Greece. And first, we physically scraped about a gram of sample of ceramic dust from inside this jar and tested it. And that gave results. And instead of finding grape DNA in this jar that was supposed to carry wine, we found olive and oregano DNA. So right away, we were pretty sure it wasn't wine. Subsequently, we talked to the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab, and we asked them how state troopers collect trace DNA from crime scenes. And it turns out they use these special swabs. It looks like a fancy Q-tip. They dip it in a little bit of what's basically purified salt water, and you can just rub this on the surface of almost anything, and these very, very grabby nylon Q-tips will pull DNA out of the material that you're swabbing. So we tried that. It actually works better than the scraping method. We've compared these one-to-one with other amphora samples, and we're finding very little wine indeed. What we are finding is a lot of vegetable matter, and that's primarily what we can test for is land plants. We can't test for fish, for instance, because of the contamination issue. Fish swim in and out of these jars.
Right.
But we're finding multiple species in these jars. Often, the majority of the jars have olive DNA. Possibly it's representing olive oil. But then we find herbal additives like sage, thyme, oregano, mint, juniper, all mixed together in these jars.
That sounds like a really great mix for some sort of marinated olives.
Marinated olives or possibly protein. So we've done a few samples looking for the DNA of cows and pigs and goats and sheep. And so far we haven't found any mammalian DNA, but the vegetable DNA preserves quite well within the ceramic matrix.
That's really fascinating. I wonder how much of your coming to MIT and to Woods Hole was being drawn to the technology, and how much do you actually get involved in developing new technologies?
There used to be a famous commercial. I think it was the actor who played Marcus Welby on TV, and he would say, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. And that's sort of how I feel about engineering. I'm not an engineer, but after spending so much time around engineers and around the physical scientists, I can talk some of the talk, if not walk the walk. So we like to have our discussions, interdisciplinary discussions, and try to come up with new ideas, new ways to take those engineering ideas and those scientific ideas and apply them to archaeology. What we found over the years is that the best team of people to go into the field and come up with new ideas isn't the team that we handpick to select for what we think are the right attributes. It's the people who are the most excited, and it doesn't matter what field they come from, because they'll bring their knowledge, which is, of course, going to be completely different from my knowledge, my background, and they'll have new insights, new ideas, and that's really a fun and exciting way to pursue science. We don't know what's coming next. We just get bright people who are really enthusiastic about being involved and let the magic happen.
What made you first want to be an archaeologist and study shipwrecks?
It was sort of the notion that you could look out at a body of water and know that it was just a big blanket that you could peel back and see what was under the covers, that there was something down there that was interesting. I was a history major as an undergraduate, but very quickly found myself attracted to shipwreck archaeology, partly because of the sort of tactile pleasures of being underwater, being on a boat, being around the sea, but also because these shipwrecks were just so mysterious and so magnificent. And one of my first experiences It was an archaeological field school up in New Hampshire, and we were excavating under the hull of a late 17th century colonial vessel. And as we dug our trench under this hull, I could see that there was what is called furring. There were the hull was oak, but laid over the oak was tallow and horsehair as a sort of early antifouling. And okay, it was just sort of a muddy, furry thing, but I realized that I was the first person to see that antifouling since the farmer or fisherman had painted it on his boat over 300 years ago. And that sense of sort of being transported through time and seeing something that no one else had seen for quite a long time was just exciting.
Now, Theotakis, I wonder about you. I mean, living in Greece, you're steeped in ancient history all around you on land. What drew you to the underwater side of things?
I started with a love to history, and then an expedition from Princeton University came to my village seeking laborers to excavate, and I was a pupil having a lot of time, and it was summer, so I went there, and I got the same feeling that, look, I'm the first one entering this room after 2,000 of years. And then I went to Athens for studies. Of course, underwater archaeology, it was something like, very remote. And suddenly after the university, I watched a seminar concerning underwater archaeology and the apply of computers in underwater archaeology. I learned diving, and that was all. Actually, I had already arranged a PhD in architecture, but they abandoned it.
You were hooked.
Yeah.
Dr. Brendan Foley is research specialist in the Department of Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dr. Theotakis Theodoulou is a maritime archaeologist for the Hellenic Ministry of Culture's Department of Underwater Antiquities. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
The remains of ancient cargo ships are, of course, the mainstay of underwater archaeologists, as we've been discussing. To this day, 90% of the world's goods continue to be transported by sea. Over the centuries, ships have been propelled by oars, sails, and most recently, motors. In a twist that might perplex archaeologists of the future, high-tech sails may be poised to make a comeback and help increase the fuel efficiency of cargo ships.
Imagine for a moment. You're that 10-year-old kid on an epic family road trip. Cruising down the road, you extend your arm straight out into the breeze.
Because everybody can think back when they did that.
Mike Garrett, an aerodynamicist at Boeing, knows with the wind rushing by and your hand turns slightly upward,
it will generate lift on your hand and your hand will want to go up.
The principle that propels your arm upward is the same principle that makes airplanes fly.
And Danielle Bernoulli in the 18th century was trying to figure out how lift was generated. And his principle was that the faster air flows over a surface, the lower the pressure is on that surface.
A plane wing's upper surface is curved, causing oncoming air to accelerate over it. So the pressure is lower on the top, higher on the bottom.
And effectively, when you take off and that wing is moving down the runway and the pilot pulls back on the column and the airplane lifts off, the wing is actually being sucked into the air. The low pressure on the top is sucking that wing up, allowing the lift of the wing to be higher than the weight of the airplane.
The same technology that allows planes to fly is being used on sailboats. 2013 America's Cup boats use a modified composite airplane wing instead of soft sails. It looks like an airplane wing, it's rigid, and has adjustable flaps that refine its shape. But on a sailboat, the wings stand straight up, where you might expect a sail to stand. They call them wing sails. Team Oracle USA, based on San Francisco Bay, has spent nearly 4 years tweaking their design.
So this is a wing that was designed for the 2010 America's Cup.
Joseph Ozane, an Oracle sail designer, cranes his neck as he walks under a massive wing sail sprawling in the rafters of Oracle's race headquarters.
When they build this wing, It was the tallest wing ever on any kind of wing in the world.
Today's 130-foot wing sails are still longer than a single 747 wing. I talk with another designer specializing on the relationship between aerodynamics and sailing.
I'm Tom Spear. I'm an engineer at the design team.
I ask him how the wing sail works.
You can think of a sailboat as basically just like a glider on its side. Even a regular soft sail acts like an airplane wing.
When a wing sail catches the wind at an angle, air flowing around the leeward or backside travels further and accelerates. Just like an airplane is sucked into the sky, the leeward's low pressure creates lift, sucking the sailboat along.
The sensation is unbelievable.
Crew member Shannon Falcone says in some conditions, these boats even outrun the wind.
You can't hear anything because you've got, you know, 60 knots of apparent blowing past your head. You feel like you're in a hurricane.
The wing sails replaced the traditional soft sail for America's Cup sailboats. And the advances piqued the interest of entrepreneurs outside of boat racing. On the drawing board now are hybrid cargo ship designs harnessing both engine power and wind power.
We have these streams of atmospheric air going across the planet all the time. And it's very fortunate that they tend to go east and west, and that's how we usually move cargo across the oceans.
Retired Admiral Stuart Platt heads Harbor Wing, a ship design startup investing in wing sail technology. Some naval engineers say fuel savings of up to 30% are possible with wing sails on board. Long ago, cargo ships required a small army to handle sails. That's one reason sails lost favor. And as global economies modernized, goods shipped across oceans had to depart and arrive on time. Fossil fuels provide that reliability.
You burn fuel, you have always a byproduct, and the byproduct can be harmful.
Harbor Wing plans to reintroduce the sail, but without the small army.
Or more simply said is, we found out how to do it without humans.
Wing sails can be operated using computers and machines. Computer-driven automation makes wing sail technology more economical and very appealing to shipping companies. But there are still some logistical drawbacks. Weight is the enemy of sailing vessels.
We don't try to sell the illusion that it will work for any size of ship.
Patrick Engelbert of Propelwind says cargo ships flying wing sails should be small and light. Large-scale cargo ships would require a proportionally sized mast and sail. That's a real concern for ship captains.
Because eventually, they will be the ones who will have to face new mistakes, etc. They know what wind is and how powerful it can be. They know what a storm is.
Jeff Cowan, a veteran shipmaster with over 17 years on cargo ships, knows about the North Pacific's big seas.
If we are experiencing 30 to 40 knot winds from the wrong direction, it's not pleasant to see that kind of water with the weight involved breaking over your bow or over the side of the ship.
Cowan lends a dose of reality for wing sails.
There's going to have to be some way to bring these things down.
Watching the new wing sail-driven class of America's Cup catamarans, it's easy to dream of the possible. Here on San Francisco Bay, the answer to a greener shipping industry may just be blowing in the wind. I'm Jason Albert.
This story was produced by Jason Albert with editing and sound design by Caitlin Prest. It's part of the STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
It's blowing your hand up and down. It's stretching.
And that's it for this week. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.